Bailiff, please bring in the witness. Good afternoon, madam. Thank you. Mr. Prosecutor, could we please have an idea as to how much time you need to finish with this witness, because we don't have a session tomorrow, and we don't have one on Thursday either because of initial appearances, and we will only begin again on Friday.
Yes, Your Honor. What I would like to do at this time will just briefly summarize the rest of the events of 1994, essentially bringing it to the conclusion of the war. And then I just have a couple, or at least a set, more than a couple of hypothetical type questions I want to pose using some of the facts of this case, and then we'll be concluded with the direct examination.
All right, that was just a question, but take your time. Take your time, you have the floor.
Ma'am, at the time when we left off, I think we were talking about the month of May of 1994. One question I have for you, which might take us back a bit, but I would like for you to briefly summarize this for us based on your research and experience. But during this period of April, May, June, and into July of 1994, did you ever come across a situation where a subordinate government official was acting contrary to the orders or directives of a superior?
Yes, there were such cases, which I have found both documented on paper and documented through witness statements of instances where subordinates acted contrary to the policy of their superior.
Well, when you say in your research that they acted contrary, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a subordinate saving people when the supervisor said no, or vice versa? Please explain this for us.
In fact, there are examples of both. If I refer to the area I know best, which is Butare Prefecture, for example, as I indicated this morning, Butare was one area where there was very little killing going on in the first days of this period, from April 6th on, April 7th on. Clearly, the directives, as understood by many prefects, about killing of Tutsi were rejected by the prefect of Butare. There's an example of a subordinate who is refusing the directives implied or stated of his superiors to kill Tutsi. Yet underneath him is the burgomaster of Nyakizu, who launches a major massacre on the 14th of, first actually was a small massacre on the 13th of April, a major massacre 14th and 15th of April, thereby clearly going against the policy of his immediate superior. I've found the same behavior in the military hierarchy, where witnesses testified to the fact that subordinates in Butare, namely a captain and a lieutenant, regularly gave orders which countermanded or bypassed their superior officer, who was a colonel. Similarly, in Gikongoro, in the detachment of national gendarmes who were in Gikongoro, the subordinate was, I believe, a captain, again, was the effective order giver, replacing his superior, whom I believe was a colonel. In this sense, it's important to develop a very concrete examination of the facts of each case to determine the behavior of officials, rather than to assume simply that position in a hierarchy automatically produced an exact and necessary sequence of orders being given and executed. It's also clear to me from my research that there were, in fact, three hierarchies operating in a more or less parallel fashion: the civilian, the military, and the political party. The political party hierarchy including, as a subset, the militia. In my work in the southern part of the country, I have found cases where the failure of an administrative authority, say a burgomaster, to participate actively in killing provides an opportunity for a political authority, say a political party head or head of a militia, who would under other circumstances not enjoy the same weight, provides an opportunity for him to become the central figure in giving orders in that context. Some authorities who opposed the killing essentially withdrew. I think of one case where a burgomaster refused to chair a meeting and simply left, saying he had something else to do. I think of another burgomaster who simply went in his house and shut the door and refused to go to the Bureau Communal and to carry out his duties. So there are varieties of behavior here, ranging from enthusiastic participation in the killing through a kind of reluctant passivity to, in some cases, a clear rejection of the killing.
Thank you. Now, going back to a more time-specific area in May, you've testified to the events, as you know it, from the month of April into, I guess, beginning of May. At this time, I would like to show you an exhibit so it can be identified for the record, and we'll let the document speak for itself. But with the chamber's permission, I'd like to show you exhibit 23 and 23A.
These documents are the French and English version of a report from the High Commissioner of Human Rights for the United Nations, Jose Ayala Lasso, on his mission to Rwanda the 11th and 12th of May, 1994.
Does this document appear to cover the events from April 6 through the period of his report?
It does, in a rather summary fashion, yes.
Thank you. Now, at this point in time, in the middle of May, what was the RPF doing, if you know?
By mid-May, their military advance had swept in a crescent kind of motion through the southeast and was circling back north again towards Gitarama and Kabgai in the center of the country. In terms of the situation in the city of Kigali, territory there was hotly contested still between the RPF and the Rwandan government troops. The RPF had taken control of part of the region called Remera in the city of Kigali on the 12th of April. And testimonies which I have collected indicate that the RPF killed a number of civilians at that time in the neighborhood of Remera. As the troops advanced forward in the east, the RPF also killed a number of civilians, a number which is yet to be determined.
And this is based on information that was told to you?
This is based on information from a variety of sources, which I've gathered over the past 2 years.
This information that you discussed about them I guess, the killing of civilians, was this a continuing process, or did it appear to be something that was short-lived?
The information that I have so far indicates that the killing in Kigali was of rather brief duration at the start, and then resumed some time later. In connection with their forward movement outside of Kigali, the killing of civilians sometimes accompanied their arrival in a region. Their stated policy from the mouth of their own official spokesman was that they would kill anyone who appeared to be in Harahamwe. But subsequent to the actual conflict situation, there is also ample documentation to indicate they're selecting numbers of people who were not taken more or less in the course of battle, and summarily executing those people as well.
At this time, with the chamber's permission, I would like to show you exhibit number 91.
This is a map prepared by the UNAMIR peacekeeping forces to indicate the military situation as of the 31st of May. As you can see, at that time, roughly the eastern half of Rwanda was in the hands of the RPF, while the western half remains under the control of the Rwandan government forces.
Thank you. As we move through May and into June, based on your work and experience, does the killings continue throughout Rwanda? And in the same fashion?
They continue, but and they continue in the fashion as determined at the end of April, rather than in the fashion of the large-scale massacres that were characteristic of earlier in April. Initially, a number of victims were women and children. Caught at massacre sites. But we have a number of cases documented where, in the early period, women and children were not to be specifically targeted. Several witnesses have indicated, for example, in the southern part of the country, that children under the age of 2 were to be spared. It's also clear that a number of Tutsi women were spared, either because they would then enter into a form of sexual service to militia members or to military, or because they were already in pre-existing stable relationships or marriages with Hutu men. There was a great concern that killing Tutsi wives would provoke anger among Hutu, and the government was concerned to avoid any break in Hutu solidarity. In mid-May, however, in the southern part of Rwanda, and perhaps somewhat earlier, perhaps the 8th to 10th of May elsewhere in the country, local officials call for a new round of killing directed specifically at the elimination of all who are left. And in such calls, women and children are specifically mentioned as targets. This then is carried out for a period of days. And then once more, the killing subsides somewhat, because those people who were out and evident were killed, they were dead already, and the others were well enough hidden that their lives were saved. And then in each community, as the RPF approached, there was a third spike, a third increase in killing, And it was at this time that many people who had previously been protected, some of them by personal relationships, some of them by paying money, were killed, perhaps in anticipation of the arrival of the RPF and as a desire to eliminate any possible witnesses.
For how long did this the conflict between the RPF and the government of Rwanda continue? Until what day?
The RPF declared a ceasefire and established a new government, which took office on July the 17th. They had actually effectively broken the Rwandan government military resistance earlier by their capture of the city of Kigali on the 4th and the city of Butare. We should note here that at the end of June, French troops arrived in southwestern Rwanda under what was described as Operation Turquoise. After operating in a more fluid fashion in that area until for a number of days, the French apparently felt sufficiently concerned about the RPF advance that they decided to establish a firm zone which would be under their protection. And this then was what was known as Zone Turquoise, a region beginning roughly at the town of Gikongoro and going west to the lake and going north roughly to the town of Kibuye. In this zone, the French undertook to prevent any form of military action, although actually the militia continued to operate and kill Tutsi for some time.
Now, what I would like to do at this time is I want to talk about some of the facts that we have been elicited in this case from prior witnesses. And I'll ask you some questions about those facts to see if they are consistent or inconsistent with some of the things you have told us in the past few days. But one thing I want to discuss, a lot of our witnesses have come in here and were able to testify as to the ethnicity of their neighbors. Now, based on your experience, having lived in Rwanda, having studied Rwanda, is that a common thing or is it unusual that someone can actually do that in Rwanda?
In my experience, that is quite common, particularly outside of the capital city or other large towns, where people coming from the country sometimes were able to disguise their origins relatively easily. But in rural areas where the population was relatively stable and families had been resident for generations, most people knew the ethnicity of their neighbors, although with changes in ethnic identity, this could lead sometimes to confusion. Sometimes neighbors would remember that so-and-so used to be Tutsi and now he's Hutu and would make that remark. Sometimes people who had arrived more recently or who were younger would simply note a given person as Hutu, even if his parent or grandparent had been Tutsi. In cases of confusion, reference was ordinarily made to the burgomaster, who thus was given the power, essentially, of life or death over a given person by stating publicly that this person was, in fact, Hutu or Tutsi. I have several letters in which people have appealed to their burgomasters to identify them publicly as Hutu and thus to offer them protection. I have one letter from the commune of Mabanza written by the burgomaster in which he announces that several children are in fact Hutu because he has checked the records of the commune back to 1948 and found that their grandfather or great-grandfather was Hutu. And he concludes the letter by saying, therefore, those children are not to be killed.
Also, we heard from one witness some testimony, and basically it was like this, that in the commune of Taba, in 1992, the MDR, led by the president of the MDR, who is the accused in this case, Mr. Akayesu, protested in front of the Bureau Communal in order to try to remove the Burgmess, who was of a rival party, the MRND. This protest resulted in violence and people were hurt. Now my question to you is this fact that I've just given you, is that consistent or inconsistent with the phenomenon of Kubuhoza that you testified to the other day?
It does indeed appear to me to be completely consistent with what I know of Kubuhoza elsewhere in the country.
Why do you say that? I mean, what do you base that on?
The information which I developed earlier in my testimony, I believe, showed in some detail how the party struggle after the establishment of multi-parties was carried on through youth groups and militia and sometimes more spontaneous groupings of the population. The documents that I have examined show numerous cases where a burgomaster is challenged. For example, Nyakizu in Butari would be a very similar case in that the burgomaster was MRND, and as a result of agitation, demonstrations, threats, and use of force, was essentially obliged to leave the commune. And then the person who had directed this Kubuhoza against him, who was of the MDR power line, won the position of burgomaster.
Additionally, we heard that, I guess in 1993 and 1994, in this commune of Taba, that the people were, I guess as well as the burgomaster, were fighting the Interahamwe, chasing them out of the commune. Mm-hmm. Is this, again, consistent or inconsistent with the phenomenon of Kubuhoza?
Are you referring to before April 6th or after April 6th?
I'm sorry, for this point, we'll refer to before April 6th.
Yes. Because the commune was the fundamental building block of the whole political system, conflicts between parties sometimes took the shape of conflict between communes. And if you had adjacent communes where MDR was strong in one and MRND strong in another, you would often see raids and attacks traded back and forth across the communal border as people of one party attacked adherents of another.
Would we see this as well after April 6th in some areas?
In the initial period of certainly of the early confusion that I described of April 6th through 12th or 13th, there are numerous examples, as I mentioned, of Hutu and Tutsi banding together to defend their commune against attack from the outside. In some parts of the country, this phenomenon continued, for example, in Butari until April the 19th, when the prefect was officially removed and burgomasters changed their attitudes.
Also, in our case, we have a situation where the commune of Taba appeared to be quiet before April 18th, meaning that there were no killings. Is this, do you find any similarities with this to any other parts of the country?
Indeed. Both in Butari and in some sections of Gikongoro, there were communes that remained very calm until, in the case of Butari and Gikongoro, it was the 18th and 19th of April when the added thrust of national government officials in the form of speeches and private meetings led by the president and the prime minister served to redirect the policy and behavior of communal authorities.
Now, in our case, on the 18th of April, we had some evidence that was elicited to show that the prefect of Gitarama planned to hold a meeting of all the burgmas. At this meeting, the interim government attended, led by the interim prime minister. The evidence we have is that the prefect expressed his concerns about the killings of Tutsis in his commune, the refugee problem, and the Interahamwe. At this time, the prime minister spoke and gave a speech, which our witness says basically was a speech asking them to support the government, saying that the government will unify the country and bring peace. And my question, as far as this little speech here by the interim prime minister, is that akin to this double language or double talk that you were explaining for us before?
It appears to me to be an example of double language in two senses. The failure to treat the matter presented, the failure to deal with the complaints made by the prefect, was in itself a message. So simply by ignoring the plea for help and guidance and giving a standard political discourse, there was a message sent, which was a clear message. But on top of that, there was the language itself, apparently, of a political speech, which stressed the need for unity, that being a code word for Hutu unity, and a concern for peace and security that appears frequently in these documents and that is, in fact, a call for peace and security, but for a limited part of the population. In other words, for peace and security, you should read peace and security for the Hutu.
After the interim prime minister spoke, the evidence again shows that the prefect spoke asking for more concrete solutions. Excuse me. And then at this time, some ministers who were also present at the meeting spoke and said something to the effect that we know that some of you are the accomplices of the Inkotani. Support us or there will be consequences to be paid. Now, I guess my question here will be twofold. In a sense, what is your interpretation of this comment? And B, what does this do to the power of the prefect publicly?
This appears to be an example of the phenomenon which I just described. In other words, the prime minister, in his speech, sent a signal, but it was a signal without words. It was a signal that resulted from his refusal to deal openly with the problem. In a sense, he has then removed himself and yielded a political leader so that the message without words, the signal without words that the prime minister has delivered has been amplified and made concrete by the message delivered by political party figures, so that the joint pressure of the administrative hierarchy and the political hierarchy is now focused on those burgomasters who are accused of inaction and who are warned that they will suffer the consequences of their inaction. I'm sorry, does that answer the second part of your question as well? I lost track there.
Yeah, actually, my second question was, what does it do to the prefect? Does it make him?
Yes. In this case, it clearly diminishes to an extraordinary extent the authority of the prefect over the burgomasters, because his appeal for help has been turned aside. His attempt to maintain order has been rejected, and the national policy is shown to be other than what the prefect himself had advocated.
Okay. Also, in this case, we heard some evidence that on April 19th, the accused held a meeting in the commune, and that he held or gave the names of various people who were, in his words, the accomplices of the Inkotani. And most of these people were teachers, leaders, or basically intellectuals. Firstly, is that something that we see throughout the country of Rwanda, where the intellectuals are being attacked?
Yes, it was. Both in the general situation of killing and in the phenomenon of people being removed from massacre sites or potential massacre sites and killed in small numbers, for example, at Kabgayi, in the cathedrals in Kigali, and so on, it was ordinarily the intellectuals and the people who had salaried jobs who were killed first.
Additionally, we have testimony that the accused personally pursued the people he listed, these intellectuals, from commune to commune and other parts. Is that consistent?
That is consistent in two aspects with what I have found elsewhere. One is, again, the existence of a list of targeted individuals, which appears to be almost, I would say, the responsibility of the most important local person, burgomaster or military officer. I have cases where after a massacre, a burgomaster would go through, either himself or with others helping him, turning over bodies to examine and identify the victims, carrying on shouts back and forth about who has found the counselor of such and such a sector, who has found the assistant burgomaster, who has found the medical assistant, indicating clearly that there was a target group and that there was a sense of responsibility for getting those particular persons. The second aspect of this, which to me accords with what I have seen elsewhere, is that officials carried this sense of responsibility to a point where they would actually go to search for people who had left their commune and sought shelter in another, because it was as if this were their responsibility to take care of eliminating those particular people.
In your studies and research, are you familiar with any commune where a Hutu burgomaster or any burgomaster resisted the killings and was killed for taking this position?
I understand that that was the case in Mugina commune in Gitarama prefecture. I have not collected information myself directly about that, but I have heard that described a number of times as the situation.
Do you know of it occurring in any other commune?
There is one possible case in a commune in Gikongoro prefecture where the burgomaster was murdered by a crowd and it was excused as some other kind of thing, but I would not be surprised to find that this was a similar case. But those are the only cases I know of.
If you know how many communes existed in Rwanda back in April 1994 and those following months?
I believe it was 147.
Do you know of any case where a burgomaster was killed for taking a passive role in the killings?
I have not seen such a case in my research. I've seen cases where burgomasters who took a passive role were removed and threatened and harassed, but not physically harmed.
But now the last area I want to talk about is, we heard testimony that on April 19th, in the commune of Taba, a teacher was killed by Interahamwe. A crowd gathers and subsequently kills the Interahamwe. The accused, in this case, shows up with additional Interahamwe and gives a speech saying, essentially, forget our political differences. The Interahamwe is not our enemy. The enemy is the Nkotani and their accomplices. My first question is just this phrase here, this particular speech, is that consistent or inconsistent with what you've been testifying to before about the unification or the Hutu solidarity?
It does indeed fit into that framework established as early as January 1991 with a concern for Hutu solidarity and the importance of union in face of the Tutsi.
Then he goes on and shows a list to the crowd that was gathered there and says that essentially that the teacher who had been killed, a Tutsi teacher, had a list. And this list was a list of Hutus who were to be killed. They also found a list, and this list was of people who contributed to the RPF. He said that the Tutsis are holding meetings and they are preparing their plan to kill Hutus. They will kill the educated Hutu, and that they want to take power and return, I think the word was us, to slavery. Now, is this consistent or inconsistent with, I guess, some of the propaganda you were talking to us before that had been taking place in Rwanda in the early 90s?
It's completely consistent with the propaganda established beginning immediately after the RPF invasion, in which Tutsi inside the country and Hutu who worked with them were accused of being accomplices, an accusation which was made concrete by a whole series of sub-accusations that the persons in question had prepared lists of Hutu to be killed, that they had stored arms, that they were in possession of radio equipment to communicate with the RPF, that they had recruited for the RPF or gathered money for the RPF or held secret meetings for the RPF. So this kind of accusation was extremely frequent, both before and during the events beginning on April the 6th. The intensity of this kind of accusation in many places suggests to me a need to justify the killings, a need to rally a population which was not inclined to participate in these killings by presenting them with a concrete sense of threat. If you recall my first discussion of the killings in Kibirira commune in October 1990, I mentioned that local officials said Hutu there had been killed by the RPF and that was why the Hutu should kill the Tutsi. The same kinds of accusations continue throughout this whole period. In part of Butari, people told me that the local officials showed them the cadastral maps, the land maps of the commune that they said had been prepared by the Tutsi to indicate how they would divide up the land of the commune once they had killed all of the Hutu. Often there are accusations of this nature throughout this period, and as far as I can tell, throughout the entire country, in order to provide a pretext for the killings.
I'd give the floor to the defense. Mr. President, Your Honors, defense wishes to intervene. You would observe that since this trial started, the defense never interrupted the prosecution in the course of questioning. If we're doing so today, it is because we have a valid reason to do so. We are of the opinion that in order to respect loyalty in debate, matters should be done in such a way as to respect legality. We have a lot of respect for the expert witness, Dr. DeForge, whose scientific authority can be contested regarding the history of, cannot be contested regarding the history of Rwanda. She is here as an expert before the tribunal on the history of Rwanda. What we cannot accept at the defense level is that questions should be put to her on facts, on precise facts of which our client is accused of, Akayesu. Madame was not present in Taba in 1994, and she cannot be put, questions cannot be put to her directly as to her opinion regarding matters that concern Mr. Akayesu directly. And this is why defense wishes to raise a strong protest against the method being utilized by the prosecution. If questions are going to be put to Dr. DeForge, they should be related to the historic aspects and to the facts and not to factual issues of which Mr. Akayesu is accused in the Taba commune in 1994. This is our observation. I thank you, Your Honor. On this matter, the tribunal did not have the impression that the prosecution wanted a toll cost for the expert witness to talk about Akayesu. Now, because he was talking about the general behavior of Bugmes in the course of these events. This is the understanding of the tribunal. Believe me and rest assured that if this had ever happened, if there has ever been a suggestion to this end the tribunal had noticed, we would have reproached the prosecutor for it. But to this moment, the tribunal has not yet found any reasons to believe that the prosecutor is given leading questions on this. But the prosecutor has asked about the behavior, the general behavior of Bugmest in that during that period in that area. He told us about courageous Bugmaster and others, and I believe we've heard it all here. That being the case, I give the floor to the prosecutor to continue, and that matter stands closed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just for the record, I just want to say that the purpose of that questioning was I was citing some conduct, specific conduct that we have heard, and comparing it to the historical perspective which the witness has testified to. That having been done, at this time the prosecution has no further questions. Thank you.
Judge Pile, you have the floor.
Dr. DeForge, I'm just seeking some of your conclusions and I don't expect you to traverse your evidence, your detailed evidence that you've given. Now, you said that there was confusion as to who were targeted for killing up to a certain date. Would you say there was this confusion on the part of the authorities as well? Like figures in the administrative authority?
The administration on April 6th through 9th, 6th through 10th, included the new interim government, but included also the burgomasters, préfets, conseillers, all the other people who had been in place for some time previously. Certainly, a substantial number of these people were unsure of the meaning of what was happening in Kigali. I'm also forced to conclude on the basis of the information I have seen that a portion of them, a small portion, understood the intent from the beginning and were not confused. It would be difficult to give a more accurate description of the situation without going into a case-by-case analysis. It's also important to remember that people's understandings and their attitudes shifted as a result of the development of the events themselves.
Is it as a result of events themselves, or would you say that there's now a clear policy directive coming from the military or the political authority? Some kind of coherent policy, a strategy to kill all Tutsis?
Again, it would be a question of how you defined the authorities. At the national level, a number of military and civilian figures and political party leaders seem to have determined that there was a conscious policy of killing the Tutsi. My reading of the information so far suggests to me that this was a small number, but that internal and external considerations permitted them to use the force they controlled as a lever to push increasing numbers of people into compliance with their plan. I mentioned earlier the control of those three key units that were the most experienced and capable of the Rwandan army. Certainly, the control over those units was an enormous advantage. Similarly, the conduct of the international community permitted those authorities who were bent on killing to go forward with no fear of substantial reaction. I focus on April the 16th as an important date because of the removal of the military and civilian authorities that we discussed this morning. And it's important to understand that the previous day, it had become clear in the Security Council of the United Nations that the peacekeeping force would certainly not intervene. And at that point, late on Friday the 15th, it looked like it would be withdrawn altogether. Rwanda sat as a member of the Security Council And I would speculate, but I believe on sound basis, that this information was immediately communicated to Kigali and was part of the decision-making process on the 16th. So it's a situation where people's positions shift in relation to their sense of threat. Clearly, some people at the very local level, out on the hills, begin to kill more out of fear of their Hutu officials than out of fear of some eventual RPF danger.
So Rwanda is not a case where the military, for instance, displaced the administrative authority or overpowered the civilian authority. They rather co-opted or secured the collaboration of the administrative authority. Is that the position?
I believe that analysis to be correct. Certainly, according to the information I have seen so far, the establishment of the civilian government, the shape that it took, the interim government, was determined by Colonel Bagasora and other military figures who supported his position. There may well have been some negotiation. I should not wish to imply that the civilians were simply taken over and had no role here, but it is remarkable that the people named to these positions included not just a very significant number of Southerners, but a number of people who were not at the peak of their political power. For example, the president, who was a man past his prime and not generally respected as a political leader, or the prime minister, who was a young man, inexperienced in this kind of power. So that among the civilians, there is not a sense of a strong determining force at the very head of government, although there are several ministers who, because of their political experience and political party connections, may have come closer to equality of power with the military.
Yes, well, at the lower authority, you said that if there was a burgmaster, for instance, who was not cooperating, who was passive, then he was removed, suggesting to the chamber that some kind of superior authority was in control of that commune.
Indeed, that was the case. The civilian administration, in fact, did continue to operate. I should not want to suggest that it did not. In fact, it's remarkable the extent to which the civilian administration continues to function in the areas that I have examined, in any case. But for example, I have been told that in the prefecture of Gikongoro, that when the prefect called a meeting of the Prefectural Security Council, that he shared precedence over the session with Colonel Simba, a military figure, retired military, but still a very important military leader. And I think that that's not an inaccurate symbol for the kind of collaboration that I would see here. In fact, one of the remarkable characteristics is the extent of collaboration between military, civilian, and political. And it is this very collaboration which allows the reaching out to encompass such a significant part of the population.
Thank you.
Georgia Spegrin, you have the floor.
Madame Desforges, to the way of distinguishing by some people the so-called Hutus from the so-called Hutus, Tutsis from the so-called Hutus. I understand that those who made these ID cards had some system for doing so. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that a burgomaster could in some cases, decide by himself whether one person was to be considered Tutsi or Hutu, that is, to decide whether that person should be assassinated or not. Now I wonder, what system did those people, both those who, those burgomasters in those cases, and those who made these ID cards, what kind of system did they follow? I understand that if you had one person whose both mother and father were, by any reason that I really don't understand, were considered either Tutsi or Hutu, but let's say so, then of course the child, of course, would be considered also to belong to the same ethnic group. But it was common, as far as I know, that Tutsis and Hutus married with each other. Mm-hmm. So then we have understood, I ask you the question, if one person had a Tutsi father and a Hutu mother, what was the child to be called?
The child would always be called a Tutsi if he had a Tutsi father.
They follow the father.
You followed the classification of the father, except in cases where the marriage was not legitimate.
Okay.
In that case, if the child was born of a woman who was unmarried, then the child would ordinarily take the ethnic affiliation of the mother unless the father was persuaded in some form to recognize the child as his.
Okay.
And this ambiguity was sometimes the basis on which ethnic identity was changed, because people would appeal to the burgomaster and say, well, actually, you know, this child was not really the child of so-and-so, a Tutsi, but was really the child of so-and-so, a Hutu.
Okay. Let's now take the case, then, that somebody's father and was a Tutsi, and the mother was a Hutu, and the child, they were married, the parents were married. So the child was considered a Tutsi. Mm-hmm. Okay. If now, say, three-quarters were considered to be Hutu, and one-quarter of the grandparents was considered to be Tutsi. How did they then decide?
It was simply a case of the paternal line. If the one of the four grandparents had been the father of the father, then all of the offspring would be regarded as of the ethnic group of that one. Say, the grandfather, you had one grandparent, a grandfather, who was Hutu,
okay,
then all of the offspring would be Hutu.
Now, my question is now, how far did they go? Say that 15 out of 16 were Hutu. Could that person be considered Tutsi all the same under the conditions that you now describe?
According to the regulations as I understand them, it was a straight paternal line. No matter how far back you went, the correspondence that I have seen does not ordinarily go beyond 1948, I believe. In other words, I have seen references of records being consulted back to 1948. And I recall that in the case of the prime minister designate, who was called a false Hutu, a Hutu who was really Tutsi, that the examination of his ancestry also went back to 1948. I don't know if that's simply coincidence. The initial establishment of whether one was Hutu or Tutsi or Twa was made under the Belgian colonial administration beginning in the 1930s. And then that designation stuck with you unless you took some corrective action, which sometimes worked and sometimes didn't.
So these people, did they take into account, for instance, social criteria or something like that?
No. According to regulation, it was very simple. It was very clear cut. But of course, there were people who succeeded in evading the system, and they did so not so much on the basis of their social status as on the basis of their wealth. So people who had the money to bribe officials found it easier to change their ethnic registration. Or people who had some personal relationship, perhaps relatives or whatever, might also have a greater possibility of doing that.
How would you consider the discrimination when it took into account only this paternal line, not considering wealth or social circumstances or whatever? How would you characterize it? What kind of a system is that? To divide people into groups only.
Our vocabulary is lacking. There are some people who believe that this should, in fact, be called a racial classification because of the emphasis upon birth connection. But in general, for lack of a better term, we have adopted the classification rather of ethnic group because of the interplay between the reality created by administrative fiat and the subjective sense of belonging to a group.
But does this system of dividing people into ethnic group have anything in common with a racist approach which was used formally in some countries, where also you could go very far and maybe consider one person who had only 1/16th of so-called blood to be considered to belong to that group? I mean, the normal mathematics thing is easy. If it's 3/4 to one and 1/4 to the other, you take the 3/4. But that is not the whole idea,
no.
As you describe it.
No, that is certainly not
the
idea.
They don't go after mathematical
rules
right. at all.
That's right. It is, I believe, a continuing expression of a set of ideas developed in Europe in the 19th century, which coincided with existing notions on the spot about the superiority and distinctiveness of the elite. It was an unfortunate union that produced a bastard.
I see. Thank you.
I don't have many questions to ask. I simply wanted to come back to the people's attitude, essentially the Hutu population. And this at the point when the killings and the massacres began, you said that in the hills people had massacred more out of revenge than out of a awareness of being Hutu. Can you clarify this perhaps? Because you stated that this was something that occurred, this phenomenon occurred among the Hutu population through that there was propaganda through Kangura, through the radio stations, in order to persuade the population that they had to do this, that the Tutsi had to disappear. Did this not have an added effect on the people? Did this not change the Hutu's attitude and incite them to kill? It's true that this conditioning, if you will, did have very serious consequences. Looking back from today's perspective, when we hear, for example, songs that talk about Tutsi as being the only enemy, when we hear about a radio broadcast which talks about exterminating a people without any problem whatsoever, when we see this in the newspapers, that would make one shiver out of horror. But it was everyday vocabulary that was used up and to the extent that it was accepted. I could perhaps give you a story of a meeting that I had. This was during a meeting of the Commission of Human Rights in Geneva with a lawyer who at that time was a human rights activist. And he had come to Geneva as a representative of his government. When we reproached him of these killings, we asked him how this could have happened. His reply was, it was normal. That is to say that he, on his part at any rate, in his reasoning, had followed these ideas to the extent that he could describe this mass killing, killing of his colleagues and fellow citizens as something that was normal. Undoubtedly, propaganda did have an enormous impact. But there was also a period during which the general behavior in terms of political violence became something that was every day. It was not something that was recognized as a crime. So for that reason, people were perhaps more conditioned to accept these killings. The third aspect of all this, I think, is the issue of fear. It is impossible to evaluate or to understand people's behavior without understanding the role of fear. And that is where propaganda really had its deepest impact. The fear that the Tutsi would come back to take power again, and that they would install a form of Hima Tutsi empire with slavery, that they would succeed in dominating all of national life, that once again they would be the masters and the Hutu would be the subjected. That is why this effort to bring back memories of the revolution at the time in which the Hutu were able to overthrow this control, that was a very important factor. Madam, I have a question that is linked to what you just spoke of, this notion of fear. A lot of witnesses here have given us examples of, for example, the prefect or the burgomaster who at the beginning was opposed to the violence. According to these testimonies, the burgomaster had even put up roadblocks in order to prevent the Interahamwe from coming into attack. But then around a certain date, around the 16th, 18th often, the burgomaster would change his behavior, his attitude. How can that be explained? Is that conditioning or was it fear? As regards burgomaster's change in behavior? Yes, let's talk about burgomasters, if you will. Those who had started off protecting the population and then as of about the 18th, changed their position and became involved in the killings. The decision to change one's policy in such a way and to participate in the killings is undoubtedly a very complicated decision. And I imagine that there must have been an element of fear, also an element of material interest, all this mixed in with the conditioning in order to then accept violence for a rather long time. I suppose that it's not even impossible that there were cases in which certain authorities themselves didn't even understand exactly why they had decided to follow a certain behavior rather than another, or to change their attitude. I don't suppose that they really took the time to reflect. But they probably saw the possibilities, the opportunities to take advantage of the situation with the looting, the pillages, or killing a neighbor, an ordinary person. They saw the possibility of being able to strengthen their position as regards a political rival, or to even climb the political hierarchy a little bit higher, political ambitions. I think this all played a role. But it's certain that the banality of violence facilitated this impact of either fear or material interest. Thank you, Madam. Mr. Prosecutor? Microphone to the judge. The defense agrees. We will adjourn for 15 minutes. It's time for our afternoon break, and we'll begin again in 15 minutes exactly, and give the defense the floor for cross-examination. Session is adjourned.
Rise.
It's Court is back in session. Bring in the witness, please. She's here already, I see. Give the floor to the defense to begin with the cross-examination of the witness. Mr. President, Your Honors. Mr. President, you have given me the floor, but I will not take advantage of this opportunity to proceed with the cross-examination because I have a serious objection to raise as regards this procedure, and I will not be able to proceed to my cross-examination. If you remember, on January 9th, you said yourself that you would scrupulously ensure that there is a balance between the defense and the prosecution. And I am sorry to say that for several days now, the defense has felt that the scales have not been even, that they have been tipped, rather. We feel that there are serious problems with the working conditions for the defense. This file is a very important file. We are working in difficult conditions. We have submitted a request to the registry specifically asking us to allow us to proceed with this cross-examination of Dr. DeForge's testimony, which has gone on for several days and for which the prosecution has had several months to prepare, that we need to have. We have this witness here who is of high academic standing, and despite the time that we have had in order to, the limited time we've had and to prepare this, we have still not received a reply from the registry. We are not here to serve any institution. We are not beggars here before the tribunal. We are free and independent lawyers, and we feel that we are being affronted here and that this is completely unacceptable. At any rate, in my country, where justice is somewhat difficult, the treatment that we have received as defense lawyers, it would never happen in my country. It is completely incomprehensible that every time that the defense asks for something, we are forced to dance around in order to obtain any results. Mr. President, now Mr. Akezu has given us instructions asking us to lead our cross-examination in a certain way. This was not respected for reasons that I've already indicated. I think that you have already received this request. We must therefore ask this tribunal that we'll be able to postpone our cross-examination because we will not be able to respect the provisions, Mr. President, that you know very well of Article 19th of the statute, which says that the trial chamber that the trial chamber shall ensure that a trial is fair and expeditious and that the proceedings are conducted in accordance with the rules of procedure and evidence, point number one. Now, in Article 2, subpoint B, the accused must have adequate time and facilities for preparation of his or her defense and to communicate with counsel of his or her own choosing. Mr. President, these are very serious problems which to us are simply unacceptable. Now, Mr. President, we are aware that it is up to the tribunal to respect regularity of this proceedings and fairness of justice. If you want for this to be well understood, then the defense must strictly have the same conditions as the prosecutor. Since January, Mr. President, I can count the number of hours that we have not been able to sleep because we have had to spend so much time preparing for this file. It is unacceptable that we are being treated in this way when we are asking for something which depends on the statute and the rules of procedure and evidence. That is why, Mr. President, I think you will appreciate what I am saying, that we need at least a few days in order to organize our cross-examination. Now, I realize that the tribunal's schedule is very full. I realize also that the tribunal will understand these arguments when they are serious arguments and that we must find a modus operandi. But, Mr. President, it is not acceptable, and we respectfully ask this tribunal to not continue accepting this behavior or this treatment which is being meted out to the defense lawyers who deserve much better than that. I thank you, Counselor. I did receive this request yesterday. And given the fact that you are working in this undertaking of justice, and that you are doing so with much courtesy and a great deal of availability. I therefore have given the instruction that you be allowed to meet the person that you would like to meet, given that your meeting with this person must be limited essentially to discussing her knowledge as a historian. So I have given these instructions immediately and so that they be carried out. Now this, of course, is based on the condition that the person wishes to meet with you as well, and that your conversation be limited strictly to the historical perspective. Now, I don't know if you have been prevented already from seeing this person, but I continue to maintain that you are fully within your rights to cross-examine, to be able to meet with this person, and to be able to situate her perspective as a historian of Rwanda, and that you'd be able to discuss these events in Rwanda with her. I cannot do anything more than that. You're the one who's telling me today that you have not had a reply. I knew nothing of this. Mr. President, by nature, I'm really not somebody to be complaining, but for a week now, Mr. President, for the last week, we have been submitting this request before the registry. Now, the defense should not have to be running after the registry's staff. We should be in our offices. Documents should be sent to us by fax, or they should be brought to us. Mr. President, yesterday, my colleague Changa and I spent all day here at this tribunal. Now, that is not very, it is not proper. You're giving instructions which have not been carried out. You can see the proof. But Counselor, I said that I gave the instructions to the registry. That's all I can do. For me, the issue has been solved. Now what we're going to do, we're going to adjourn. We are not in session for this case tomorrow or the day after. And I hope that within the next 2 days, you will have the opportunity to meet this person and then be able to proceed with your cross-examination on Friday. I hope so as well, Mr. President, based on the condition that we'd be able to meet with the witness. Session adjourned.